Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Smooth. I think we'll leave it just as is. That was perfect.
Well, there was a snort somewhere. I was the countdown, and then I heard a little snort. And then that's Brian Brushwood you just heard.
Yeah, that's right. What's up, people?
Brian, what are you going to do with your Brian Brushwood logo if Buckaroo Banzai comes back as promised by Kevin Smith?
Oh, I'm so excited for that. By the way, that's for those of you guys who don't know, I'm wearing a shirt like 10 years ago. I wanted a cool logo, but I didn't have any resources and no artists or anything. So I was like, you know what? Buckaroo Banzai had a cool logo. Let me just pay tribute to it by stealing it. And I figured one of two things would happen. Either people would recognize it as the Buckaroo Banzai logo with the bees facing each other, and they were like, oh, that's awesome. That's Buckaroo Banzai. Or they would not recognize it, and they would think I'm awesome. So it was kind of a win-win.
Win-win, totally. I have a Team Banzai headband somewhere in my house in Florida.
Oh, that's great, dude. Buckaroo Banzai is such a great Mary Sue of a hero character. It's amazing.
Dude, Buckaroo Banzai was kind of like a life model.
Really, you're like, at this point. Well, I guess you're right, because first you toured the world, and then you're like, well, now let me write some best-selling novels, and hang on, let me be a star of stage and television, and I'm
working on the interdimensional thing. We'll see. Well, if there is a real-life Buckaroo Banzai, it is one of the frequent topics here.
Hi, guys, I'm here too.
I introduced you at the very beginning. All right, wait, sound check. Did I not say Justin Robert Young?
You did not.
No, he did not. You missed it, I think.
Sorry. Sorry, Justin. It's rare that I have you here. I sometimes forget that you're part of the show.
I mean, come on. I made both the shows last week, like while I was out doing stuff. I wasn't on video.
Shows.
I was.
I did two shows. Give me credit for this. I did two shows.
Hey, man, can we get back to our post-apocalyptic road trip?
We're going to after this first segment, Brian.
Oh, wait. Oh, right on.
Okay, sure. We can do another 30 minutes on Buckaroo Banzai, though, too. We just keep that in our back pocket.
I'm okay with all of this. All of this sounds awesome.
Yeah, I don't know what's the downside on that. We had a interesting – there was a unveiling this week. Elon Musk did a – it was a – they attempted to do a live stream, but for some reason, outside of Reno, Nevada, it may not be the best place. It's all those UFO bases the government has. Their live stream did not quite go all that well, but they did upload the segment, and it was the unveiling of the Gigafactory, which is Elon Musk's plan, or Tesla's massive, massive factory built in conjunction with Panasonic, which is going to be producing the battery packs for Tesla vehicles, specifically, or most likely the Tesla Model 3. The problem is that if you want to build a bunch of electric cars, you need a bunch of batteries. And if you're going to try to deliver the 500,000 Model 3s that Tesla has already taken down payments on, or whatever you want to call those advance payments are, that means that you need to have a hell of a lot of batteries. And they looked at the total global supply of batteries and realized that just there wasn't enough capacity on the entire planet to be able to deliver this. So therefore, they needed to build their own battery factory. And Elon Musk also looked at this as an opportunity to reinvent the factory itself. And keep in mind, too, this is an interesting sort of, you know, there's this the Chevy Volt or the Bolt versus Tesla sort of thing. And there's a lot of fans of that talk to like, well, that, you know, they're which horse they're betting on, which I think it's great that the more players, the better, but they don't have any plans for building massive battery factories. It's one of these things like there's criticisms that those other car company electric car initiatives are really being done just to meet government mandates and, you know, their fleet requirements, not to actually create a viable alternative to what they're selling. And that is warranted by the fact that none of them are really planning to build battery factories in any large capacity or putting in the capital investment you would need in order to support that kind of massive shift in the way vehicles work. But
so I'm going to assume you've already read all of these articles and you can walk me through it. But I remember hearing some talk that there might simply not be enough lithium for all those batteries that are planning to be made, or it's like we need to discover more lithium or something.
No, there's lithium is not going to be a problem. Lithium is a relatively abundant thing, and it's only a very, very minor part of the chemistry in there. And again, when we say lithium ion, I mean, it could be, there might be other metals that play a much bigger place in it. And there was a couple years ago this scare because the Chinese were starting to, you know, buy up a bunch of these different rare earth minerals. And there was this panic of what happens when we get them. And that was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And that didn't bear out the way that we thought. You know, I mean, predictably, if you study economics, you know, like, oh, well, we'll immediately start looking for alternative sources. And companies were even developing motors that didn't even require magnets or using entire electromagnets and stuff. And those prices have fallen considerably. Yeah. But, you know, they have, to my knowledge, Tesla has been making deals to make sure that they can maintain a steady supply of lithium in dealing with extraction and making sure that they're going to be able to do that. But that was never, you know, I don't think that was going to be as a serious problem as we feared.
So quick side jag, what about helium? Like, is helium going to be a problem?
So, okay, so the helium thing is interesting. You know, helium, on one hand, is one of the most abundant elements in the universe. On Earth, it's because it's a gas, and once it reaches atmospheric level, it tends to escape. There are actually numerous sources of helium, but we created kind of a scarcity because we had a, in the United States, we created this big, huge helium reservoir, which was to, you know, conserve our helium supply and to make it available. The problem was is that for the longest time, we were selling that at below, let's say, what market prices would be. So we were de-incentivizing anybody else from doing helium, you know, capture. Every time, just about every natural gas well you produce, you create, and you're pulling methane or whatever out of the ground, you're going to get helium. But it's not cost efficient to try to capture that helium. So we don't. And what's happened is that we created this artificial market of very, very low prices. And then we tried to correct that, but then we made it a much more complicated market. So there's still not a lot of incentive to try to create it. But when we look at actual helium reserves, if you type in Google search for helium reserves, you find out that under the Rockies, we think there's a ton more of it. We think there's a lot of it that's available if you just want to spend a little money to get it. And you know, like oil or other things, we reach the sort of the limit of the current technology and we're like, well, we're going to be running out. And then turns out we're not. So here's a headline. We're really not about to run out of helium. No, please stop it. We're not. And it basically goes into the fact that helium is very abundant. It's one of these things that you have to develop ways in which to sort of, you know, capture it. But we've just not been incentivized to develop that. So,
Yeah, and this is we've talked about this before, but I believe it was a Matt Ridley quote that he points out that humans have never ever run out of non-renewable resources. Full stop. Like what happens is right when you get to that point where you're about to, the price goes up enough that you just never run out of it because you find alternatives.
Or in our cases, you find better extraction methods. You know, that's been the story of fracking, and that's why peak oil, you know, here we are in 2016, and peak oil is not really a serious thing anymore because we've discovered there's so many other proven reserves, there's so many other sources of this stuff, and we've developed technology to utilize when we reach certain price points, when it gets above $50 in oil, like, oh yeah, we'll use this technique to use these, you know, this cruder grade. But if it gets to $100 a barrel, we'll go to this. If it gets to $300 a barrel, we'll go to, methane hydrates, which, you know, will last us thousands of years. So it's one of these things where we like to do the doom and gloom and the helium thing. And there's short-term problems. Absolutely. Let me make very clear. Short-term problems in helium production is that you could run into a problem where, you know, you could use the currently available supply and then you have to go back and build capture systems and stuff like that to produce it. And it's to try to get like higher grades of helium too, to get it refined into like pure helium is costly and all this. But it's just a matter. It's a matter of money in a growing economy, which, you know, for the last several hundred years, our economy has been consistently growing upwards. These things do become cheaper.
All right, last question. My grade school chemistry seems to remember that I know that humanity is working on fusion reactors instead of fission reactors. Once we crack fusion, wouldn't the product of two hydrogens be a helium? Wouldn't we be able to just manufacture all the helium we want?
I mean, the energy cost on that would be so absurd.
Would be insane. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
So I mean, what's interesting too, though. But to your point, though, is where does the helium come from? You know, because it's oozing out of the ground here. Why is it there? And it may very well largely be a byproduct of the fact that we are sitting on top of a large nuclear reactor. You know, I mean, we have at the center of the Earth's core are all these extremely massive radioactive elements that are producing tremendous amounts of energy, and on top of the immense pressure contributing to the heat and producing things like some of like helium.
Wait a minute. I don't think I'd ever heard this before. The idea that, I mean, I knew the core was hot under the pressure, but I thought it was all just nickel and iron in there just glooping around. There's talk about actual fusion happening beneath the surface of the Earth.
Fission.
Okay. All right. Oh, yeah, got it. Yeah. So you take heavier elements that break down into helium. Got it.
Yeah. Meh,
meh, meh. It goes both ways. I'm smart.
Yeah. Yeah. So our Earth, what can't it do? Radioactive menace. So anyhow, what we're looking at after that big jag is the idea of this massive, massive factory that's going to be, you know, robotic. It's going to be constantly evolving and not at all Skynet. Not at all Skynet.
I mean, you know my position. It's like, look, man, it's all going to be Skynet at some point, whether it's gently or forcefully. We're you know, it's humanity's children that are going to be around.
Let me ask you this about the Gigafactory. Considering what they're looking to do with like the power wall and everything, is there a chance that by the end of this, the Gigafactory is the biggest thing that Tesla does, and not making cars? Like, just because the capacity of bigger, better, more robust batteries has more potential applications?
Well, I question that just because it seems like all this battery technology is very iterative and very, very tiny movements of the needle is in an increase of quality. And there's no doubt that a tiny movement of the needle in terms of efficiency and affordability will make a huge, huge difference to Tesla. But I don't know that this is their legacy. Aren't we, you know, when we're looking at, you know, 10x jumps for liquid metal batteries and so on. I don't know that this is their legacy, but I'd be interested to hear what Andrew thinks.
I certainly think that, you know, part of it is that we look for these other radical technologies, and as we're waiting for them to be mature and reach the market, the one that we've been this one improves, and we get more efficiencies out of it than we thought, and that's happened a lot of different things with silicon, et cetera, what have you. And to the question of what does this mean, you know, Tesla, and when Elon Musk revealed his new master plan, part due, he talked about Tesla becoming Tesla being an energy company and also getting into every sector of transportation. They're just completing their acquisition or merger with SolarCity, by the way, which is they now want to be able to, Tesla doesn't just want to be able to sell you an electric car. They want to be able to sell you with sexy electric panels that you can put on your roof that can then charge your power wall. And yeah, I mean, we're going to do, I think they're very much on to whatever the next generation battery technology is going to be. But, you know, there's a long ways from something working in some way on a lab bench to figuring out how it's cost effective and to make it economical. And there's so many opportunities commercially between there, and that, you know, we're seeing that we're going to get on lithium ion technology, we're going to get cars with 500 mile ranges. You know, we're going to have that. That's not going to be a problem. You're going to get with lithium ion technology, you're going to get the capability of, you know, a power wall that can power your house for a week. You know, these things will, you know, within a cost effective range within the next maybe 10 years or so. And yeah, we want those newer technologies, that sexier stuff, but it can take a long time for those things to mature and become price effective, even though the materials are cheaper. Because remember that there is one of the problems we have when we talk about like, oh, we need to bring manufacturing back to the United States. It's not just the fact that you have a factory in China. Is you have a factory in China next door to a factory that makes batteries, mm-hmm. next door to a factory which produces the chemicals that makes the batteries, next door to a foundry that produces the metals that you use inside of those things. Is you need 500 factories to do that, not just the one that assembles it. Otherwise, you're shipping all that stuff to here, and you could say, great, let's have all those factories here. Well, we've spent 30 years getting rid of these dirty, nasty factories out of our country. And trying to shift, you know, our workforce into something above manufacturing. And, you know, there's so many things that go into play there that it's not just it pops out of it. But that's kind of the weird direction we want to get into, though, is the idea of having these factories that can build anything. Have these factories that you could build batteries, you could build LCD screens or plasma screens, what have you. You could build cars and do that. And that's one of the next waves of manufacturing that Elon Musk is hinting at, is the idea that maybe we can get to the point where we just take the raw materials in one end and produce the full item out the other side.
Yeah. Man, there's a million different tangential threads I want to.
Bryce just threw up the graphic that Elon Musk showed, which is called vertical integration. And it says, has one side that says raw materials, then a factory, bunch of stuff happens, and then finished goods output.
Bunch of stuff happens.
Yeah. Musk says he's going to try to patent that formula.
What's funny is like, on the one hand, yes, he's a brilliant man and he's visionary and he seems to be batting a very high average. But on the other hand, you read that and it's like, this dude is writing crap on the back of a napkin after getting hammered one night. Like, you got stuff. Stuff happens. You have finished products. Also, let's make a reference to Hot Shots.
He measured the Gigafactory. They were talking about, like, they explained that it can hold 93 Boeing 747 jets. And then Elon Musk pointed out 50 billion hamsters. Yes, he certainly is. You know, that he has people around him that try to keep him in check whenever he starts to pontificate or go too out there. And you heard him say, like, I'd like to talk about electric airplanes, but they've gotten upset at me. But he full out said, we're building a tractor trailer,
Yep.
We're building an electric semi, electric one of that. They're building a bus. And Jalopnik said maybe it'll be based on the Model X platform. And Elon Musk says possibly. So, yeah, he's going a lot of different directions. He's got some really gifted engineers, and it's exciting. You know, it's exciting. It's one of these things where, the critics have no shortage of things to point out, you know, of that. But this is – they were very – 10 years ago, people were very critical, and here we are in 2016 watching him unveil the largest, by square footage, largest factory on the planet.
Well, and that's what it kind of makes me think that there might be something more to the through line of the batteries, is that push comes to shove, whether or not every single one of Elon Musk's applications for those batteries pans out, the world will need higher capacity batteries and has for the past 25 years, right? Like, mm-hmm. all we do is create more and more and more different, delightful, amazing things that all have the thing in common that they need better batteries constantly. And he's created a factory to put them out in mass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that he's very clear now. All the elements are there. They're acquiring Solar City, which is the largest, installer of solar panels in the United States. They have the Powerwall. They have all these elements. They're building an energy company. They're building a transportation and energy company. And the two biggest sectors of our economy are transportation and energy. He wants to take what they've learned in transportation, apply it to commercial areas, and go all in those directions. He wants to take what he's doing in energy and making it much more modular instead of trying to build an entire utility. He wants to build on a house by house level, build your own sort of your own utility that you can then plug back into the grid, what have you. And, you need, and it's one of the things that sort of gets sort of, one of the problems, sort of misunderstood things when it comes to a lot of these renewable energy sources is that, we're like, well, we should build massive solar farms. Great. What do you do at night? And that's where you build massive solar farms, and then you end up having to build, gas powered plants, natural gas plants, whatever, to provide your energy at night, because the storage storage on a massive level is extremely expensive in the Tesla models to try to push that down to the individual level. People say, what about wind farms? Great. What about when the wind ain't blowing? Where's your energy coming from? You still got to build your energy plants. You still got to build these gas-powered plants and stuff. And so, you know, the big missing point in those forms of renewable energy is the storage. And either we're going to go try to have some massive storage thing where we're building football fields worth of batteries somewhere in the middle of, you know, places, which then becomes its own problematic and environmental hazard. Well, we try to move that to the home.
Let's talk about that. I would love to hear more about the safety things they're doing on the Gigafactory because, you know, lithium ion batteries, the moment they get exposed to air, they explode. And you got a whole factory of this stuff. It just seems like a potential disaster. That's what happens when your laptop battery melts and starts charring and going crazy as everything oxidizes. It's lithium, as I understand it, and I'm going to get the chemistry all totally wrong, like lithium as it occurs in salts is bonded to stuff, and then we refine it, and you get the pure lithium that are in the lithium ion batteries. But the moment it's exposed to air, you get those uncontrollable fires the way we saw when Tesla stock took a tanking when that one viral video came out of it. So that's I'm curious, and I'm sure they've thought about all this. I mean, it's not new technology, but the explosive nature of it all seems scary.
You know, when Tesla first started and they were, you know, talking about putting batteries in there, there was the concern about the batteries, you know, and they Musk and the Tesla engineers point out, like, you're sitting on 20 pounds of gasoline.
Oh, sure.
You know, that we transport around there. Anything that stores energy has the potential to rapidly release that energy, or just about anything does. And so that certainly is a consideration. And, you know, but we've been building electric battery. We've been building battery plants for 200 years and, you know, whether they're in some form or other. And I'm sure they're considering this.
Yeah. I guess I would just love to know more about how they ameliorate that risk.
Yeah, build it in Reno, Nevada.
Speaking
of building things, we're building something right here.
Hey, man. Yeah. We love doing the show. We love doing it on the reg. We hope you enjoy it. We hope we bring you awesome news and surprising facts and some silly scenarios. And you can support us, keep us regular, by heading on over to patreon.com/weirdthings and join the 400-plus patrons who keep us on the regs.
We need you. We need your support to make these things happen.
It's true.
Without it, we might not find out what will happen to Justin and Brian on the road in a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
So where were we last time? We had just headed out west, right?
So you're headed out west to go find your pal, Andrew Main. And for those of you just tuning in, here's the scenario. Some virulent plague has just sort of wiped through and killed off almost all of humanity. Brian was huddled up in his house, podcasting to his dogs. And there was a knock at his door, and Brian almost picked him off with his rifle because he's paranoid and scared of everything around him. And he realized that scraggly stranger was none other than Justin Robert Young. And the two of them decided to build themselves a battle wagon. What did you decide on, a van? What kind of vehicle did you decide on?
Yeah, like a mid-sized van. Although, man, did we get an angry tweet from some of our cyclist contingency that saying I was right and that the post-apocalyptic vehicle of choice is the bicycle.
Okay. And then they said that the logic was with me, but they were emotionally attached to their bicycles.
What one of our listeners wrote in, where it should also be noted that he is a endurance marathon bicyclist. He is very, I mean, this is somebody who was, before he blew out his leg, which is its own commentary on whether or not this would be a great thing to have, long term, was trying to go from Oakland to Austin via bicycle and had made it to Arizona before he injured himself. So he was very invested in his bicycle.
Well, yeah, then he's proposing that in a dangerous post-apocalyptic wasteland that you use this same technique that failed him.
I still feel like all things being equal, the simpler method of transportation is the best. And I probably on my own would be having some kind of bicycle, super lightweight, low infrastructure necessity thing. But absent that, we're in a battle wagon. It's diesel powered.
You gotta go over 1,000 miles, Brian. You're going cross country,
yeah.
And you have cars, and you decide on a bicycle, and you have hostiles everywhere.
No, okay. First of all. So far, there's not been a single hostile encountered anywhere.
Right, I'm the one telling the story. So I know.
But second of all, you're quieter and you don't announce your. I would say if it was just me, I'd be on a bike. But it's not just me. It's me and Justin. So we're in the diesel battle wagon.
Yeah. It's a 24-hour drive.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's head out west.
You don't know what kind of weather you're going to encounter. I didn't tell you this winter, and you're going to be out there in your damn
bicycle going through
snow.
Once and for all with this bicycle thing, you got the bicycle thing from the zombie apocalypse book, right?
Yeah.
Which I think heavily overweights for the idea that a swarm of zombies would attack you and that they would be attracted by the sound.
No, the principle was the same, is that you don't want, if you're in a hostile environment, you don't want to announce your arrival with all these engine noises and stuff. It's a highly visible, very difficult to be sneaky.
You want to be able to get out of the hostile environment as fast as you can without being vulnerable. My problem is Brian, I want you to imagine that you know, what you didn't know is, like, I went, like, totally crazy and insane, and I realized that, like, I did not want to be the dude on the back of the motorcycle in Mad Max with the chain around my neck. I needed to be the dude on the front of the motorcycle, okay?
Right.
All right?
Okay.
So what highway are you on? You're on I-10?
Yeah.
Guess what I'm doing? I'm roadblocking that shit.
Okay, but since I'm not in a vehicle, I would ride my bike out into the desert around.
You don't know that I'm not like, I don't put a sign up there like the coyote from Roadrunner telling you there's a roadblock, Brian. What? It's a secret road. I got snipers and stuff. I want your stuff, you know? So, like, you don't know that, you know? And you're like, I'm on a bicycle. You come to a bridge, Brian. I roadblock the bridge, okay?
Okay. Well, man, this is a weird. I thought we were going to progress the story. We seem to be going backwards here.
Because this is bicycle thing. I'm just like,
no, Brian. This is the argument that we're having inside the battle wagon, because we still haven't settled. Even in our post-apocalyptic world, we haven't settled the bicycle conversation.
I mean, and then of course, the weird part is, like, there's a giant double barrel bike rack in the back of this. Are you sure we don't want to just even take a bicycle, guys? It just seems
have Brian. You can put whatever bikes you want in there, you know?
All right, good. We're loaded up with bikes.
Brian's like, I needed to go to the library. Why? I remember an article about a Navy SEAL team that used bicycles.
Okay, but see, that's not fair, too, because, like, Navy SEALs have the infrastructure and support of modern military teams. We have no infrastructure, no support, and no way to predict where we're going to end.
All right. How about this? We're going to split the baby here. We agree that the best way to get long distances, right, is in our battle wagon, and that we stop in secured areas and then to investigate towns and gather provisions, which we would want to have more silently instead of pulling right into the center of town with all of our universe. We grab the bikes, we get on our compression shorts, and we head on into town with our backpacks.
Now you're talking. See, that's smart. I like your style.
Totally on board with it. But Brian and Sislin taking a clothespin and a baseball card and putting it in the spokes so it makes a.
I just like it. It sounds like I'm on a motorcycle, guys.
So, you guys got to lay down some ground rules here then, okay? Because, like, you're driving along, you look up ahead, and you see somebody walking along kind of dressed and, like, covered up, really, like, maybe holding on to something.
Oh, geez. So your question is, like, do we treat other human beings as predators or compatriots?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would kind of look for... So have we encountered one?
This is your first encounter, Brian. You see them up ahead on the road. Do you stop? Do you guys have a discussion?
All right.
I would say yes.
Wait, hold on. Let's go ahead and lay out what our objectives are, okay? The first thing that we want to do, if there were some sort of natural disaster, right, like a hurricane or something like that, we would understand that the world was indeed in peril. But would you stop for everybody that seemed a little lost along the road before you got back to your family, Brian? No, you drive by them, you'd find your family, you'd get everything settled, and then you would look to help other people. So, I mean, part of me says, hey, listen, sure, it might be terrible that they're living in this post-apocalyptic world, but until we get to LA for Andrew and Oakland for Ashley and find out whether or not they're okay, my capacity to help, my reservoir for compassion has kind of run dry.
No, I disagree, because here's the thing. This is the reason the United States is largely an extrovert society, is because during frontier days, when you got to an area, you need food, water, and you need information. You need to know where the Indians are attacking and this stuff. So there's a evolutionary bias to...
Why are the Indians attacking, Brian?
Whatever, natives. They're all attacking. Everybody's attacking us at all times, and I need to know what's going on. And so that's why you make the four-mile hike over to your neighbor, you knock on the door, you shake their hand, and you're like, I'm Brian. I'm a real person. You're a real person. Let us exchange information. The most valuable of resources. And so in that regard, we have to have a frontier mentality. We have to stop and talk to everyone we have the chance to do so, unless we get information suggesting that that there's an ambush in wait. Now, we don't have to be dumb about it. We could just chat with them, and maybe you got like double-barreled sawed-off shotguns, you know, trained on them as we approach, and then have a
all
conversation.
Right. So here, I hop out of the front. Just like open up the door, right? And I'm doing like the standing on maybe the seat, so I'm leaning over the door like it's a shield thing.
Yeah. All right, now we're talking. Okay.
I'm like, hey, all right, drop your guns and lift your sack.
All right. Hold on. He didn't mean that. He's a little uptight, this one. Hi,
Lift him!
All right, hi, I'm Brian. This is Justin. We're doing podcasts across the ruins of America, and we saw that you... Would you like to hear our podcast? We could do it for you right now.
I'll shoot you in the face if you don't drop your gun.
All right, no. Listen, I'm sorry. He's a bit of a nut one, this guy. He's the wild card.
And you know we're playing good frontiers.
So you get closer, and it's a woman.
Oh, it's a woman. Oh, that's great.
She's holding a bundle. Holding a bundle in her arms.
How old is this woman?
You know, just a little scraggly looking, maybe mid-20s maybe. She's holding something in her arms.
Throw your bombs on the floor as hard as you can.
No. Hi, what's your name?
Oh, she's startled. She turns to you and she's, you know, amazed, and she eyes light up and she smiles and she says, my name's Tessa.
Hi, Tessa. I'm Brian. This is Justin.
I thought we were all alone.
Oh, no. Just 99% of all of us have been killed. We found that out because Andrew Main is our friend. You haven't seen Andrew, have you? I know he's still 10,000 miles down the road.
No. Andrew who?
Okay, that's fine. It's fine.
What you're holding isn't a bomb by punching it in the face as hard as you can.
What you got there? Do me a favor. Stay still. What you holding?
This is my baby Thomas.
Wait, Thomas was spared from the plague?
Oh, we were very lucky. We're very, very lucky. I took care of him.
Team meeting.
Okay, real quick. I mean, I think she needs some water, and I got some prenatal vitamins, maybe.
There's an old frontiersman tale that says she needs two things. The sound of our squealing tires and our exhaust.
That's not a real thing.
Look, God.
All right, look, you realize that if she's holding an actual living baby, then that's important scientific advancement. We could find out maybe there's a genetic way to defeat the plague.
Okay, file that one under W for who gives a bleep. Down the road, this lady is creepy and weird.
Let me just chat with her a little bit more. Hey, Tessa, listen, crazy new bit we're doing on Night Attack on the Road. It's called Justin Thinks You're Holding a Bomb or a Dead Baby. Let's settle it once and for all. We have a straw poll going on this old piece of poster board we found. Right now, the votes are 1-1 for dead baby, live baby. What say we wrap this bit up?
He's just sleeping.
Okay.
All right. Come on.
Can you show him? How close to? Okay. Here's the question. We gotta know if this kid's alive. How close do you get? Do you get within? Do you walk up?
I'm going negative. In fact, I'm walking away from the car because it's too close for my leg.
I'm walking over, hunched over, hands up in a non-threatening way, walking as close. I get like two or three steps away.
All right, before you walk over to her.
By the way, there's an actual straw poll running right now, and the votes are coming in. So far, it's 2-1 on dead baby or bomb.
Ryan, before you go over there, have you heard my favorite song? I got a song stuck in my head.
Yeah, what is it?
No. We need to go.
One second. Let me get close. I get in and I just reach up and I pull back the blanket off of whatever she's holding. What do I see?
What you see? We'll talk about next week.
Oh, damn it. On
Weird Things. One more time on the bicycle discussion. All right, new rule. We're done with this bicycle thing, right?
Yes.
Look, I think we reached a great compromise.
I think we all are on the same page. My concerns about infrastructure and having to fix cars is settled because we have the bicycles as a backup.
Fine. Why are you putting a bell on the bike? Why are you doing that?
Ching, 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 ching.
He's got the horn. It's like rigged it out to the most baller bicycle ever.
Yes.
I know. We pick up, like, next thing you know, we're rolling like those the East LA lowrider bikes, you know.
Yeah. He's got a big stereo on the back.
Lowrider. Yeah, dude. I'm looking at a picture of it right now. I'm gonna look great. So do we have another story or do we want to go into picks?
We can jump into picks if we want and then go right into after things if you like.
Yeah, let's do picks because I got a nostalgic pick for you guys. And I was thrilled that Bryce hadn't seen it. I stumbled across Gary Whitta is the writer of Book of Eli. He wrote the script for Rogue One coming out this fall. I've been following his career since in 1990s when he was editor-in-chief of PC Gamer magazine, and he's done a few podcasts and stuff. But I noticed that he had changed his @Twitter avatar to something that nobody would recognize.
And just a quick side note, he's not actually the writer for this version of Rogue One.
Well, yes, but he wrote the original script, and then I don't know, you know, it goes through the Disney machine and everybody makes all the changes and then something comes out.
Yeah.
Do you guys recognize his Twitter avatar?
Oh, shoot.
Don't say it. Describe it.
I don't.
Describe it for the audience if you can, though.
It's like a celestial arrangement of planets.
Yes.
It's like a star chart.
Yes. It looks like a blue, faded, dusted up star chart. We'll see if anyone in the chat room gets it either. But I instantly recognized it, and instantly I was back in the second grade because that is the infamous map from Time Bandits. And if you haven't seen it, Time Bandits is one of the most delightfully strange, outrageous movies with such powerful, dark, postmodern, insane imagery in there. It was directed by Terry Gilliam back in, 1981? Yeah, 1981. David Warner, who would go on to play all the bad guys in all the movies you ever watched. He was the bad guy in Titanic. He was the bad guy in
Tron.
He was the bad guy in everything. John Cleese shows up, Sean Connery, Shelley Duvall, Ian Holm. It's amazing. And also 12 Dwarfs that you didn't know about. Kenny Baker, the guy who was inside R2-D2, right?
Yeah, he was the one. He was inside R2-D2, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So it's about a bunch of really dumb dwarfs who worked on the creation of the planet Earth for the Supreme Being, but they're not too bright. They found a map of all of the frayed edges in the fabric of the universe, And so they decided with this awesome power, they were going to abscond and steal stuff throughout time in history. And they end up pulling a kid along for the ride, and it's so awesomely
encountering Napoleon and others. It is one of my favorites. I own it on iTunes. I love that movie so much.
Yeah, you can't stream it anywhere right now. You can rent it just for a couple bucks on Amazon. That's probably worth it. But if you can buy it, then that's
I bought that thing. That was my pick like a year ago. You go back, and it's one of those. There was, from like 1980 to 1985, there was such a wonderful period of movies because of the success of Star Wars, Jaws, and, you know, like Raiders. And I mean, Star Wars and just some of the summer movie sorts of things, the success of Kid Fare, where kid movies all of a sudden became the highest grossing movies, which was not the norm prior to basically Star Wars. You had a lot of really amazing things happen that you never were going to happen again like that. You look at that period and you have Back to the Future. You have Time Bandits and so many of these other amazing films that came out. And
So in trying to tell Bryce about it, I encountered the trailer, which I hadn't seen in forever. The trailer's delightfully postmodern because it begins with a trailer guy talking about how he does trailers and wants to eventually get in front of the camera and act. And then they start comparing it to Star Wars and listen to some of this.
You went to Superman to see a man fly. You went to Star Wars for the droids. You went.
Now watch.
What's page two, man?
It's on the page one. See? Oh, man.
Star Wars. Time Bandits can offer you much.
I didn't realize this is our America Grindhouse trailer, man. I just realized
you haven't seen bandits travel through time like this, America.
And it's written by Michael Palin and Terry Gilliam. I mean, and so it's very much if you love the Monty Python universe, yeah. This is a wonderful doorway into part of that.
Yeah, a lot of that, like that unseen arguments, both internal and external kind of bit that was used so effectively with Monty Python is certainly on display. I love this movie. This movie's great.
Great appearance by Sean Connery in it, too.
Yeah.
It's nice sort of way he shows up. Justin, do you have a pick?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've kind of been in you know, a media black hole over the past 3 weeks with the conventions and everything. So I haven't really seen a whole lot new. However, you know, I did read a lot of the reviews for Suicide Squad today. It comes out on Friday. And it has made me really, really, really excited to rewatch Guardians of the Galaxy. And not necessarily a slam on Suicide Squad. I haven't seen it. I don't know exactly, you know, how much how much this movie succeeds or fails. But a lot of what the reviews have talked about in terms of where it struggles is in trying to introduce a lot of new characters. And I even read one review that said, you know, imagine if you had to start the Marvel Universe with the Avengers, which I don't think is the proper comparison. And the closer one is, how amazing did Guardians of the Galaxy do in introducing, you know, within the first half of the movie, all of our main characters, giving them all unique characteristics, all unique personalities, all unique motivations that all kind of wove in and out. You include characters like Yondu and Nebula. You know, Thanos is obviously this kind of big, larger, sinister figure at work. But, you know, it just did such an amazing job of, you know, Andrew and I were talking about, you know, origin stories and everything yesterday. And specifically, that first pre-credit sequence with Peter Quill and his mom and his family that ends with him getting abducted, spoiler alert, is like amazing. And it just shows you how much that film got storytelling, got characters, and was able to just sort of skip a lot of the tedious stuff that I'm going to just assume, since I read it in so many different reviews, that, you know, is maybe a clunkier part of Suicide Squad, where you've got a few characters that are obviously leap off the screen fun, and then there's like, you know, all the oins and gloins, you know, of the Hobbit franchise, where you're just like, okay, I guess these guys are just sort of all on the train too.
It's, man, yeah, I listen, we'll have to see it, figure it out. But
I won't see it. Protest vote. That movie is owned by DTNS, and I'll be good goddamned if I'm going to give them even $1 on their movie draft.
Yeah, of course, that always an argument. Like, we should see it before you decide. I'm like, well, like, do I have to give my money to everything? You know, like, there's like the Ghostbusters debate. We should see it first. Like, well, you know, I'm not that interested in this whole discussion. So, but, you know, Suicide Squad, like, man, I mean, this is certainly something we want to be good. And I, you know, we hope that maybe the fans are going to have a much stronger reaction and positive than the critics have so far. But it's hard when you want to do those ensemble things. And then often you when you see the signs of movies that you look at, you like, you go, oh man, they had a thing and then they went back to try to make this thing work. Pixar's brilliant at that. Marvel has been fantastic at that. You know, we're going to find out how good they, you know, Disney Star Wars is with that. You know, but the problem often is like, oh, we need to put this thing, we need to top load this so you care for the characters. And that often just fails because it's like, yeah, great, maybe we like them up front, but if we're not caring for them throughout the rest of the movie, then that's you can't front load that with anything that'll make that work. But not to say that's the case here at all. So we'll see. The Rolling Stone review was...
Yeah, I haven't read that one, but that is apparently an absolute thrashing.
There's the headline I'm seeing right now said, Suicide Squad review, these heroes may be bad, but their movie... is even worse.
Well, it describes the direction as limp male appendage and then says made Fantastic Four look good, which I don't think is possible. I think that's just that sometimes the pile on critics is, you know, a little bit. And listen, you know, there's often been things where the critics don't get and people love. So, you know, I think I don't know anybody who's rooting against this movie. I don't know anybody that's rooting against it.
Including us. I mean, except for me, because I don't want Team DTNS to win the summer movie.
Box office.
I just need an underperforming first week, and then that's fine. As soon as the trajectory is off, then we can all go see it immediately on week two. What I think is the most interesting is that the proportions in which these characters are in the movie, you know, specifically... You know, I only in this last round of television ads that I saw pop up during the conventions did I see Will Smith's Deadshot be like, you know, anything resembling even a co-lead with Harley Quinn, Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn. And to read all the reviews, he's the pretty much the protagonist of the movie.
Well, given the box office success of their last duo effort with those two guys.
Yeah, exactly. Crackling off the screen already. You know, I think it's one of those things that's actually like not surprising because why would Will Smith want to do, you know, a movie that he's, you know, going to be the third lead in? But at the same time, you know, I think it just shows you how much Warner Brothers feels like is riding on this movie. That they've tried to just steer so, so far into whatever fan perception was to make that be the movie that everybody wanted. Although, you know, the one other thing, and just I want to make this about how much I like Guardians and how much, not how much I'm now dubious about Suicide Squad. But, you know, one of the other elements of the reviews is that apparently this is like a chock full of pop songs kind of film. That like almost every other scene is a pop song.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that like, you know, using the idea that Peter Quill has this tape player and it's got this mixtape and it means something to him. And so now either when we're physically seeing him play a song on either his ship or on his headphones, or, you know, we're just hearing songs that are also from that era, it always kind of came back to this emotionally resonant point as opposed to just being a Mountain Dew commercial where they paid a lot of money.
And plus also, not only was it emotionally resonant, but it also implied that there's a level of self-reflection to Peter Quill that you don't ever see on the surface. He's all just being an asshole and all about being in the moment. But you know that every time he's listening to that music, he's really thinking about being home and being in that moment with his mom.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It was a character choice and not a filmmaker choice. And that's often problematic where you watch stuff and then something gets my problem not, and again, I know it's rare. Like, part of my problem with Batman versus Superman is that, like, that one of my many problems with that. And there was a great breakdown explains problem is that, like, that's a movie composed of moments and not scenes, which was my criticism of Man of Steel. And then he uses as an example the farmhouse scene in Avengers. Like, here's how you can have a whole scene, which I'm like, yeah, that's a scene that didn't need to be there. But the point is taken is that these moments in Batman versus Superman and Man of Steel, it's like, if you're not, it's like, if some super fans are going to feel it, if you see Superman on the screen, they're going to get excited. But like, man, did they like really try to push that soundtrack to try to get you to feel something, you know, no, really, we're going to play this louder now. You're like, the Wonder Woman stings every time she does something might be kind of cool. They do the same damn stings. And I'm like, yeah, this is what you do when you're trying to fix something that ain't there. And yeah. I was nervous about the Suicide Squad commercials and how they were like, they tried to fix Batman versus Superman by using like the rock score, and then watch them do the same thing with Suicide Squad, where they're really trying to push that in the commercials with this. Here's these great rock songs, and here are these, you know, here's this movie that has absolutely nothing to do with this whatsoever, other than we're trying to tell you we're cool.
Mm-hmm. then the fact that we also listen to the Wayne's World soundtrack.
Yes. But that was a soundtrack that was perfect to them. It fit them.
Great. I mean, I have that soundtrack. That was great. Yeah. I mean, it might be the only reason why Blitzkrieg Bop is in any way looked at as anything other than a terrible song, because it's not a great song, but it was amazing in Wayne's World. When
don't
you believe
start a Ramones fight, man.
Dude, it's not the Ramones, is it? I thought it was somebody else. Sorry, Blitzkrieg Bop. I thought you were talking about.
Ballroom Blitz.
Ballroom Blitz.
Sorry, wrong song.
And I would say that I'm excited to find out they are going to release a Stranger Things soundtrack.
Oh, great!
Yeah,
very cool.
Looking forward to that. My pick. So I've been working on a project, which we'll be talking about more at some point. It's a thing for authors to make their lives much easier and like easily create websites, et cetera, for them. Because when I'm writing, I can't listen to lyrics. I can't watch TV. I have to be focused on writing. But when I'm coding, it's totally different because then I can watch TV and stuff. So I've watched a ton of TV as on my little iPad Pro here as I sit here in front of my computer. And I've got enough picks for like months now. But I'm going to go with two picks. One quick pick. They only did one season. It was based on the Christopher Pike series Spooksville. Really enjoyed that. I think it was on Amazon. But my big pick, Gordimer Gibbons, Life on Normal Street, the Amazon original show.
Oh, man, I don't know anything about this.
Yeah, no.
So this is, I saw the ads for it, and it kind of looked to me like, it looks like kind of like, you know, kid fare, whatever kind of thing. But let me, you know, I'm looking for something to watch, so why don't I just go ahead and watch this? And the first episode was... It was a little bit quirky, a little bit slow paced or whatever. But then once I got into the groove of it, I loved it. It takes, you know, elements of Adventures of Pete and Pete, Erie, Indiana, really fantastic kid casting and casting, whatever. It's this kid who lives in this place called, you know, lives on Normal Street, and he and his friends get into these adventures that have like weird outcomes and stuff. So it's got this sort of sci-fi fantasy element to it. Extremely well done. It was the story of this is interesting is the guy who created it, David Anax Agoris, and I actually wrote him a fan email just to tell him how much I enjoyed it. He kindly responded back. He got into screenwriting. He wanted to be a screenwriter and wasn't having much success. And he'd been a preschool teacher before, and he decided to give it up. He gave up screenwriting, and then the last thing he did was Amazon had an open call for submissions for TV shows, and he put together his idea for Gordimer Gibbons' Life on Normal Street and submitted it, and the next thing you know, gets greenlit by Amazon, and
he's created
his own TV show. Amazon did a 13-episode first season, and then they did a double season two, so I'm watching this. I'm like, I'm getting really into this, and then I get to the end of like the season two. I'm like, man, this is a great cliffhanger. I can't wait to see how it ends. And they find out, like, nope, that's it. This is it. This is the entirety of Gordimer Gibbons. There are going to be no more episodes. I'm like,
oh my God. This is an Amazon Prime thing?
Amazon Prime and Amazon Original. So Gordimer Gibbons, highly, highly, highly recommend. I think for our Weird Things audiences, I think people would really dig it. It's a fun, fun, quirky show. It's the kids on it, like I said, the characters are very well developed. It's a very neat premise, and just really enjoy it. So
he was quitting, and then he got this thing. Is he now going to do more stuff, or is he like just following?
Oh yeah, I mean he's produced one of the most highly rated children's television shows in the last couple of years now. So I think he's probably back in the business.
Good. All right. Good. Because yeah. I didn't know if that was factoring into your like no more episodes ever thing.
No, it's like on this website he says no more, and that's it. And then I guess that was the final deal with that. And so I don't know if it's, you know, never say never, you know, but I know talking to some people, like there are pros and cons to doing Netflix and Amazon deals and, you know, the good side and the bad side. And I think sometimes creators like, that's great. Now I want to go do elsewhere. That might be the case. I don't know.
So yeah.
I can pester him again and ask him more questions. So.
Yeah.
Hey man, when is your next thing? Remember when you did that show?
It's awesome. Yeah.
All right, chat room. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is starting to prove that Marvel's getting TV. No, never. Daredevil proved that.
Yeah, fair enough. But Daredevil is almost a very different animal. I mean, just the world of broadcast television versus what they attempted or succeeded in doing with the first season of Daredevil.
It's run differently than the...
Yeah. The rules about the kind of stories that they can tell and...
The stories. Yes. Yeah. Biased. I have a friend of mine was the head writer for season 2 of Daredevil.
Oh, no kidding. Mm. That's awesome. Dude,
no idea. I'm like, this is really good. And then the credits come up. I'm like, why I knew her?
That's awesome.
You know, pull up my phone, I'm like, OMG, this is so good.
That is awesome.
Cool. Gentlemen, no matter where you are, there you are. Something like that. It's been weird.
Yay!
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.